1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News,
app.
I'm Andy Field. The Coast Guard searching for a downed aircraft off the coast of California's San Clemente Island. A Coast Guard spokesperson confirming to ABC that the plane was contracted by the Navy. U.S. already seeing a surge in migrants at the southern border in anticipation of the end of Title 42 this week. But Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas tells ABC's Karen Travers.
We are working very closely with the government of Mexico and other governments in the region to address the challenge of migration.
Title 42 was the pandemic rule allowing migrants to be turned away at the border. Republican New York Congressman George Santos entering a not guilty plea in federal court to 13 charges.
He has already been exposed as a liar. These charges now allege he is also a criminal, even though George Santos told reporters outside court there in Central Islip that he believes he is innocent and will not resign.
ABC's Aaron Katursky. This is ABC News. New York City Mayor Eric Adams condemning the death of Jordan Neely, who was placed in a chokehold by a passenger on a subway train. It is the end of the COVID emergency.
Thursday marks the official end of the White House declaration of COVID-19 as a public health emergency. COVID response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha says it obviously marks a transition for the U.S., but he insisted the Biden administration will continue its work to protect Americans against the virus. That includes investing $5 billion for vaccine development and treatments, more research on long COVID and how to address it, and more resources to improve indoor air quality nationwide. Dr. Jha saying the end of the public health emergency isn't the end of COVID, adding COVID is going to be with us as a long-term illness. Derek Dennis, ABC News.
A committee in Kansas City, Missouri, sending the city council a resolution that would make the community a sanctuary for people seeking or providing gender-affirming care. That comes as the state's Republican-controlled legislature signs off on banning gender-affirming care for minors. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane McNair. Here's what you need to know. Four people were hurt after an apparent explosion at the Windsor Condominium Complex on Madison's west side Tuesday evening. Fire Chief Chris Carbon says one of the units in the building is believed to be the origin of the blast. Carbon says at least six units were affected. The entire building is now uninhabitable. 22-year-old Krista Marie Welch has been missing from Polk County since May 7th. She left the area in an unknown vehicle after getting a call saying her niece was injured and in the hospital. Police say her niece was not hurt. Welch has ties to the Green Bay area and also in Maine. Since leaving, she's had no contact with her family or friends, and her phone is off. Welch is also believed to be no longer taking her mental health-related medications. If you've seen Krista Marie Welch or know where she is, please contact local law enforcement. I'm Jane McNair. This is Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council. If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba.
Please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Wanted to start off today with an email from Mark in Cedar Rapids. Who reminded me that we met in Cedar Rapids back during our Working Class Heroes tour and wanted my opinion on a New York Times opinion piece that he asked if I wrote. Now, my name is not on it, but he said, look, you know, the reality is everything that you talked about while you were here in Iowa and as I listened along the tour was exactly what they're saying in this opinion piece. Several months later. And look, I like to believe that the New York Times spends all of their time listening to the little program here and happy to share my ideas, happy to share my beliefs, my ideology, all of that stuff with them, because clearly they generally are not all that concerned with working class people. So if in some small way they picked up on this from our tour, from, you know, 18 years of doing this, good. It needs to happen. It needs to be done. And you know what I'm talking about is there was an opinion piece over on the opinion page at the New York Times. And the title was One Thing That United These 12 Biden and Trump Supporters. And the one thing is, as I've been saying from the very beginning, the one thing is the fact that in order to reunite and revive our economy, reunite the country, revive the economy, we need to reunionize. We need to organize workplaces. We need to reclaim the lunchroom. We need to have that commonality that brings us together. And what's that? Better wages, hours, conditions. We want to be able to support our families. We want to be able to take care of our families. We want to make sure that we go home safe. Those are the things that can unite us. Been saying that for all 18 years of doing this. And shocker of shockers, when the New York Times actually gets out of their ivory tower and goes out and grabs a couple of people and asks them a couple of questions, guess what they come up with? Exactly what we've been saying. That, you know, across political ideology, across voter registration, nuts to bolts, people believe that they should have better wages, hours, conditions, and are willing to fight for them. I do find some of the answers that they gave around their union membership to be in line with some ideological bends of, hey, you know, I'm an individual. I don't really need that collective action, but I'll take it because it works. A lot of complaining because we're a complainer society. But it was interesting, you know, when they started asking questions about solidarity, they started asking, you know, what it means to them, what working class means. It's a lot of what we've been saying. Now, you go back through our Working Class Heroes tour, and we went to a lot of places that are struggling. We went and we chose those places on purpose to try and come to this. Because it's always been my thesis that, you know, you give people a decent wage, you give them a good job, give them a future, you know, all the other stuff will come around. So they grab 12 people, you know, all over the political map, and they bring them together and they talk about the working class things that we wanted to talk about back in October and in November up till the election. They're within the realm of reality. They're between the curbs, if you will. They're not standing on the sidewalks, you know, shouting and throwing at each other. And it's my belief and my hope. It's my great hope that we come back to talking to each other. We come back to a together around the water cooler at the lunchroom, because that's how things get solved. And the more polarized we are, the more that we put on our red hats or our blue hats, and the more we divide ourselves up into teams where my team has to win and your team has to lose, nothing gets done. But this little article that they came out with says, yeah, we're politically polarized. When you talked about working class issues, there was consensus. There was, again, across, you know, Republican, Independent, Democrat, across all of the hats, there was some consensus, which is why you need politics to divide us. If it's not political, it's got to be religion. It's got to be something. There's got to be a divider. And I say this all the time. I remember a moment when the lunchroom was united. And when I first started working, you would go into a lunchroom and everyone was in the same kind of world. Their kids were going to going to schools. They had the same kind of, you know, positions in their life. The older people were, you know, trying to help the younger people. There was a community there built. And it was when right-wing talk radio really began to take hold. And I still remember the day one guy brought Rush Limbaugh's talking points into the lunchroom and the division began. Because it was no longer about how do we all do better, it's how do I do better. It was no longer about how do we get the best we can get for everyone and our community. It was the heck with you, I want mine. And that was really the, in my view, in remembering how we lost the lunchroom to radicalism. That was it. That was the kind of moment that, you know, I remember when the business agent from our union would come in and say, hey, look, these are the people that we're supporting across the political spectrum, Democrats and Republicans. And here's why, because they support us, because they support the right of collective bargaining. They support the right to join and form unions. They support the right to having a closed shop to ensure that we don't have this division where we're ripped apart by these no rights at work laws. Everyone picked up the cards, put them in their pocket, took a second one for their spouse and said, yep, we're all on the same page. Because why? We want better wages, hours, conditions. We want better opportunities for our kids. We want better schools. We want better. The old Gompers quote, what does labor want? They want more. More of the things that make life better, more noble, more beautiful, all of those things, and less of the vice and the division and the hatred. What do we have now? We've got a lot of division. We've got a lot of hatred. And I believe a big portion of that is because we've unorganized the workplace. It's now hooray for me and the heck with you. It's now everyone's, we're over 40% of people are gig workers now, which really is, I will literally slit your throat for a penny so that I can take whatever this thing I do and make a buck off of it. Because we're all now little capitalists. Eating each other. And that is a perfect world for the real capitalists at the top who are using your labor cheaply. So when I see this piece, I'm like, finally, about time someone is picking up on the idea that we've been talking about here on the show for a very long time. The question I have is, what comes out of it? I've said this before. I do believe, and look, we've done a number of these tours over the years. We've done a number of get out the vote activities. We've done a number of you know, town halls and stuff. How do we get to the point that we all want? Which is, you know, the kind of job that isn't a life, that we work to live, not live to work, that we have some health security, retirement security, so that as we get older, things aren't as difficult, and we're not as worried. Because I think a lot of the problem that we're suffering through right now is, you ask anyone, and these folks who were questioned, they're not wrong when they say the economy is not great for them. They're not wrong when they say they're concerned that things are not going in the right direction. They're not wrong when their concerns they believe are not being addressed. They're not wrong. And this is where you come back to this idea of solidarity. And as I've been saying for years, every generation has to figure that out, has to rediscover it, and then move forward on it. Are we in that moment yet? I don't think so. I don't. Now, what's interesting is when they got to the argument of politics, this is the interesting part. That's when the division happened. So we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs that, I remember an era where you could sit and you could argue about anything political. We could have heated discussions, yell and scream and all kinds of stuff at each other. Call us anything but, decent Americans. And when we were done, laugh about it. Have a beer. See you tomorrow. We're not that society anymore. It's now we've created, because of our media culture, we have created an environment that says, I have to win. And therefore, you have to lose. And I have to dominate you, and I have to destroy you. Which is insane. Because that's not how it is. I know that's how the very well-to-do want us to think. So that we keep eating each other. We keep fighting each other. And we end up with bad politicians. I was watching the Donald Trump town hall, and I'm going, really? This guy is a contender? This whiny, self-centered, he can only talk about grievance? He can only talk about being the victim? This is the guy that could be leading this country again? It's an interesting moment. Because I think we could do so much better. We should be able to do so much better. And it goes all the way down the whole way. We don't vote for things anymore. I used to believe that I voted for policies. Yeah, because one of the things that came up during this conversation with the New York Times and the 12 people that they had was, should unions be involved in politics? And well, no, they shouldn't be. And my response to that is, yeah, they have to be. Because one of the political parties is trying to make them illegal again. One of the political parties is trying to neuter them. That's the reason that they became political. This whole, 1947 forward, the Republican Party, over the veto of Harry Truman, creating out of whole cloth, out of just thin air, this idea of, you have the right to work. Now, you don't have any rights, and you don't have any work, but you have the right to work. Again, no rights, no work, but you have the right to work. It's brilliant messaging. But what it really means is you have the right to work for less wages, for less security, for less safety, and for more profit for the boss. That's what you have the right for. And they sold us on the idea that, yeah, that's what we want, that some want. Finally, I think people are coming around to it's bad policy. It doesn't work. States that have these designations have higher death rates on the job, have lower wages, have lower health care access, lower retirement access. But we're still told it's going to create jobs. Never mind what the governor of West Virginia said, that they passed the whole no rights at work package. They went after right to work. They went after and did away with prevailing wage. They went after all of those things that corporate America says that they need to thrive. And guess what? Nobody came. Because when you're at the bottom of the barrel, when you finally reached the bottom in this race, they're going to go where it's more profitable for them regardless. And this is where I come back to the idea of solidarity and understanding that working class is not a bad word. this is that moment. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you see a way forward? Or, you know, as some have told me, the only way forward for us as a country and as a working class is the next depression, that only misery and economic chaos bring people together. I hope they're wrong, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
There are bank records. Evidently, they're bank records. Republican from Kentucky, James Comer. He's the House Oversight Committee chairman. Big rally today, big press conference about evidently the Biden family. They have bank records. Did you know that? Did you know the Biden family has banking records somewhere? Evidently, that's what he said. And he came out during his conference, said, for the first time, the American people are going to see actual bank records that show wire transfers from adversaries around the world into a web of LLCs that were owned and controlled by the Bidens. And those transfers were made back to the Biden family accounts. Hold on. The money was transferred to the Bidens, and it was the Bidens' account. Isn't that redundant? But does it lead back to Joe? Now, interestingly enough, they never quite say that. But there are bank records. My thought is I'm watching Comer do this, and I'm watching my congressman, Scott Pardon Me Perry, tweet out, bank records don't lie, but president sure does. I don't know what that means, but because I don't know that he has weighed in on this. But this is one of those moments where the right wing was all in a tizzy today. They needed this. It was cover. It's all about Biden, and you know, there's all this nefarious stuff going on. And look, I'm not saying nepotism doesn't happen. Never said that. I've never said that Hunter Biden didn't go, hey, my name's Biden. Give me money. I've never said that. But there's nothing there that says Joe Biden was involved in this. But the Biden family, because evidently they released a 36-page memo accusing family members of earning millions of dollars while Biden was VP. And now, again, no evidence that there was any link to the vice president, him at the time, or the president now. None of that. But lots of allegations. And I love when Republicans do this because they do it masterfully. I should say I love when politicians do this. But Republicans do it much better than Democrats. And look, Democrats either, you know, get them to stop or up your game because you're falling off because you had Trump to go after, you know, with Ivanka getting all the patents from China while she's actually working in the White House. The son-in-law with the billions of dollars from Saudi Arabia while actually working in the White House. This is one of those, they're pointing one finger at Biden while everybody is pointing back at the Trump administration and Republicans. Never mind. Nothing to see. Move along. But this is what they do. Now they've said, because, you know, Comer, you know, went to the FBI and said, hey, we want this specific thing, knowing that the FBI isn't going to give you one specific article of anything. They're going to say, okay, there's an investigation going on, and we can't, you know, you know the language, you know the, you know, we can't give you this because there's an ongoing investigation, potential ongoing investigation, you know, failure to disclose, you know, such a thing would, you know, it would harm our future possibilities of investigating. It would prejudice prosecution or judicial proceeding, unfairly violate privacy or reputational interest, or create misrepresentations in public. So they're basically saying, there's nothing here. We don't have anything. But if I give you this one thing, you know, you're going to use it and blow it out of proportion. And we're not going to get in the middle of this. While having said that, being smack dab in the middle, because now Republicans go, see, look at them, look at them. There's there. And there's not. They're masters at creating this. And again, they've got this echo chamber that does an incredible job of ramping up this heated rhetoric and the conspiracy around every corner. And there's now a conspiracy that, you know, Biden got, you know, he's the big guy, got 10% of all money that the Biden family took in. And again, there's no proof there. And, you know, but it doesn't matter. You don't need proof in this world. Now, interestingly enough, today, New York Republican Congressman George Santos turned himself in. He has been charged with 13 counts, 13 crimes, actual crimes. Not, hey, we think, not, hey, there's a memo somewhere, actual crimes. You know, things like, wire fraud, things like misusing funds while in office, you know, actual crimes that could send him to jail for quite a bit of time. And I look at this, and he was released on $500,000 bond. Now, he didn't pay it. Someone did. Question, who? Don't know. But when a sitting congressman, just throwing this out there, when a sitting congressman is released on $500,000 bond, that's a pretty big freaking deal. Kind of a big deal if you ask me, because it's a lot of money. And they made him surrender his passport. So it's my mind going, you know, they think he's going to flee. They think he's going to put on his drag queen outfit and head off to Brazil or wherever. And I was a little disappointed. I got to tell you, I was a little disappointed. Because I see Santos as a guy who's an attention whore. I mean, he just is who he is. It's all about me. If you watch the presentation that he gave while, you know, just yapping his mouth, where if you're a lawyer, you've got to go, please shut up. Please stop. You're killing me. But he on and on and on and on. But didn't show up in drag. And I was a little disappointed in that. I thought that would have been, that would have given him a little more flair. He certainly would have gotten more attention. Now, he and an unnamed political consultant evidently encouraged donors to give money to his LLC instead of the campaign. Oops. Can't do that. He then used the money for personal expenses. That is against the law. He applied for unemployment benefits during the pandemic, even though he was employed by an investment firm and made $120,000 a year while claiming he's not getting any money. That's a big one. Also lied to the House of Representatives on their financial statements during the campaign in 2020, overstating one source of income, failing to disclose another, and then did it again in 2022. And there are tons of questions that an actual trial, will solve. And for me, I care about what the person in the robe at the front of the room, Yeah, they call him Your Honor with the stick, with the little ball on the end. I care about what goes out in front of him, not what some congressman on the steps of the Capitol looking for attention is saying. I think Georgie's in trouble. Could see some time. Could see a lot of time. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2005. That was the day United Airlines got the A-OK to ditch its pension obligations in federal bankruptcy court. Workers were dragged through years of employee ownership schemes, massive layoffs and concessions, and the gambling away of hard-earned pensions on the stock market. Then in 2002, United filed bankruptcy. Many asked, how could this happen to an airline owned by its workers? By 2005, creditors like Citigroup and JP Morgan were fully in control. Employee ownership had meant trading billions of dollars in deep wage cuts and givebacks for stock ownership and a couple of seats on the board. Controlling interest meant a six-year no-strike pledge, the slashing of tens of thousands of jobs, and massive outsourcing. By 2005, the stock was worthless. Then United moved to weasel out of union contracts just 24 hours after the court ruled on the pension default. Some 130,000 pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, and ground service workers found their employee stock ownership plans empty. United executives turned billions of dollars over to the federal government, who then administered what was left through the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. In most cases, those pensions were slashed in half, and monthly retiree health insurance costs exploded by 700%. One pilot stated, "I call it legalized crime. I lost almost all my United stock value in the bankruptcy, and here's another part of the retirement I was promised that is gone. Where does it end? You feel brutalized by the system." Somehow, the $6 million in benefits then CEO Glenn Tilton received wasn't affected by the default. Now that United is swimming in hundreds of millions in profit, many retirees have demanded the restoration of their original pension plan.
I'm a child of privilege, not the privilege of money. I come from a family of small-town working people. But it was my privilege to grow up in the public schools of Denison, Texas. There I received the rich blessings of dedicated classroom teachers, a diverse student body, playground socialization, librarians, coaches, cafeteria and custodial workers, student politics, vocational training, and a deep appreciation for the unifying value of community and the common good. That's why I'm flabbergasted by today's clique of corporate profiteers, theocratic zealots, and laissez-faire knuckleheads who are lobbying furiously across the country to demonize, defund, and dismantle this invaluable social benefit. If ignorance is bliss, they must be ecstatic. Public schools do have some real problems. Politicians constantly slashing education budgets, professional burnout created by understaffing and low pay, the devastating strain of a killer pandemic, and a new normal of assault rifle murders. But the profiteers, theocrats, and knuckleheads aren't interested in those. Instead, focusing on what they say is the fatal flaw in public education, teachers. Yes, the claim is that diabolical educators are perverting innocent minds by teaching America's actual history, showing students that the full diversity of humankind enriches our society and presenting our earth as something to be protected, not plundered. And worse, oh my gosh, many classroom teachers are union members. So teachers suddenly find themselves political pawns in the GOP's culture war. "Our schools are a cesspool of Marxist indoctrination," squawked Senator Marco Rubio. And Donald Trump squealed that schools are run by, quote, radical left maniacs and pink-haired communists. This is Jim Hightower saying, these right-wing chicken littles are demonizing America's invaluable educators because they need someone for people to hate, providing cover for their unpopular plot to privatize education.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the CNN town hall with Donald Trump wrapped up, and it was every bit of the live fest, the grievance fest, the giant S show that you would imagine that it would be. It was that and oh, so much more. A couple of things jumped out at me right at first. He actually took credit for the Supreme Court overturning Roe, which my mind immediately goes, hold on, did those justices tell him something different than what they told the confirmation folks? Because remember, they believed in decided law. And for him to say, hey, I did this, he had to have some different information. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the giant S show, I've asked my good friend Craig Harrington to come share some thoughts with us. He's the chief cook and bottle washer over at Media Matters for America, MediaMatters.org, the website. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on again, Rick.
So, gut reaction on the CNN. It's just like a clown show, setup. Any thoughts?
Yeah, it was a total disaster. If there's any silver lining, it's that CNN, as the third ranked cable news network, didn't actually show this to very many people. Like, best case scenario, a million people maybe tuned in. Worst case scenario is their typical 500,000 to 700,000 in prime time. You know, CNN is a distant third place network, and they did this because, frankly, they're desperate for ratings and they're starved for this attention. But man, the attention is not positive.
So it didn't help. My question then, did Van Jones come out and say today Donald Trump was presidential? Did we get that from Van?
Yeah, it was actually very interesting. In the immediate post-game analysis, CNN did this thing that they've adopted a little bit since the 2020 election. They had their first panel of journalists where their sort of center chair was Jake Tapper. And then they had a second panel of the political analysts where their center chair was Anderson Cooper. And that's where Van Jones appeared. In that first panel, though, it was like Dana Bash and John King, Jake Tapper, Abby Cornish, Abby Phillip, one other person whose name escapes me, but all real journalists. And they were just kind of shell-shocked. Dana Bash, just shell-shocked. They were like blown away by like, oh, this was what Trump is like. We forgot a little bit of what this experience was. They were shocked by how much he lied.
Wait a second. These are smart people. Yeah. I want to believe they're smart people. Are you telling me they forgot the 4 years of chaos we went through? They forgot that this guy will lie when the truth would be better. And if you get off his narrative, he's going to steamroll over you. They forgot?
Some of the, I don't remember which commentator or which of their journalists it was, but one of them actually said, if you had forgotten what the Trump experience was like, this reminds you. And he just steamrolled Caitlin Collins, who was the host. And, you know, I guess she did as well as she could have. But like, this was not a situation where she could have succeeded. She was alone on the stage with Donald Trump. There were something like hundreds of Trump supporters in the room. They were technically undeclared voters. But almost everyone they interviewed was like, they supported you in 2020 or they supported you in 2016 and 2020. One of them wasn't old enough to vote for Trump, but said they were undecided heading into this, but like they're still a college Republican, like a registered, a member of a Republican group. And so like, this was not a situation where a journalist could succeed. And the journalists watching this seemed to have like this shocked realization, like, oh wow, this was what the Trump show was like. But to address your first point about Van Jones, you know, February, 2017, Van Jones sort of goes down in infamy, for his response to Trump's first ever speech to a joint session of Congress, where he said he literally like fought back tears and said like, this was the night that Donald Trump became president.
I know,
because Trump addressed a war widow, essentially, for a frankly a military operation that was botched by Trump. And Jones, since the November of 2020, since the election night in 2020, he has really had a heavy pivot away from Trump. And he was just sort of disgusted and aghast by like the performance that we saw. But again, like, this is what CNN in their pregame coverage started to talk a little bit about, like a thing they've become a meme for, which is like, would Trump have a pivot during this conversation? Would he use this as an opportunity to, I think they said, will he adopt a more, quote, balanced tone? And no.
And you wonder why no one watches CNN.
The post-game analysis from their political pundits, even the sort of the former Republicans and former Trumpers on it, everyone was kind of surprised by how combative he was. But most of the people who are watching this, I think if you're following along on Twitter or obviously here at Media Matters, like we were watching this with much of our staff. And like, this was what he wanted. Our president, actually, Angelo Carasone, tweeted very early on that like Trump was having a blast. He was clearly enjoying himself. This is what he wanted. He wanted easy. He wanted easy sound bites. He wanted to be demonstrated sparring with a reporter, ideally with a woman reporter. Yep. He wanted to have these easy rhetorical wins where he could spew his well-rehearsed lies. He wanted to be fact-checked, because if you notice in that room, which was hundreds of Trump supporters, when he would lie, they would applaud. And then when Caitlin Collins would fact-check him live, he would just roll right back through her and push right back and shove right on, and they would applaud him again. There were only two instances in more than an hour of questioning where she really just dug her feet in and stopped him in his tracks, and he got defensive. On one of those instances, he kept claiming that he built the wall along the Mexican border, which he did not. And she over and over and over just reiterated, you only built 52 miles of wall. You only built 52 miles of wall. You only built 52 miles of wall. And he got trapped on that. And she beat him on that one instance. On another instance, she just over and over said that he wasn't telling the truth about the Presidential Records Act, which he claimed allowed him to steal those documents when he left the White House and take them to Mar-a-Lago. And she just over and over again dug her feet in. But on other instances where she wasn't as persistent, or where he was simply more persistent, we saw really poor spectacles from this. For instance, the very first question was about the 2020 election, and yep. He promoted the big lie. He didn't explicitly say that Joe Biden and Dominion voting systems and Smartmatic voting machines stole the election and rigged the results against him. But he said that if there was a fair election, and people have questions about whether or not 2020 was fair, if there was a fair election, he would be president. And he reiterated that again. She asked him at the very end if he would commit to accepting the results of 2020. And he said, yeah, if I think it's a fair election, which means if he wins. And so if he wins, he'll say that he accepts the election. And if he loses, he'll promote the big lie, which led to the insurrection at the United States Capitol, which potentially had the which carried the potential of overthrowing the United States government and installing, you know, a dictator, which is what many people in the crowd on January 6th, 2021 were looking for when they stormed the United States Capitol building. He called Ashley Babbitt, who is an insurrectionist, a dead insurrectionist who was killed on January 6th by a police officer who was defending the United States Capitol. He called her a patriot. Collins said nothing. He called that police officer a thug. Collins said nothing. That police officer is black. Collins said nothing. Donald Trump then claimed that the police officer went on TV and bragged about his role in defending the Capitol on January 6th. That did not happen. She sort of pushed back and said, like, he didn't say that. But she said that off camera. He just got to steamroll through this over and over and over again. Now, because of that, because he's so undisciplined and so out of control, he actually walked himself into a couple of mistakes as well. There were the two instances where she really pushed back on the wall and on the Presidential Records Act. And then there were two other instances where he potentially looked bad. He took very proud ownership of the Dobbs decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. He said that he did that and he was proud of it. Yep. And he was honored by it. And he said that that was him, that he overturned Roe v. Wade.
No one else could do it, only him.
And that is going to go into ads for eternity. And then I'm trying to think off the top of my head what the second instance was where he sort of slipped up. There was an instance where he brought up the Access Hollywood tape again, and he actually defended his position in the Access Hollywood tape that as a star, you're allowed to sexually assault women and it's not assault because they want it because you're a star. And so that he created a couple of instances where like Democrats are going to run ads about the things that he said because he's so undisciplined, but that combative nature, the sort of like the wrestling heel mentality of Trump, you know, it is on full display in a situation like this town hall, and it is to his benefit. He only wins in this forum.
But here's the thing. When it comes to Trump, I don't think there are any undecideds. Does this move the needle any? No. Did this make any difference? No. This was just more feeding his ego, which is why I thought CNN doing it was stupid. Putting him out there and giving him an hour just to riff off of whatever he wants is just crazy. I mean, my favorite line for what I watched was when he was talking about the illegal votes and how many votes were, he said there were so many illegal votes in Wisconsin, they didn't know what to do. What do you mean they didn't know what to do?
Yeah.
We got all these illegal votes. What do we do with them? I mean, it was crazy listening to him just spew and But, you know, this is what he is, and it's who he is. And anybody who expected this leopard to change his spots should not be in any political position of analysis or journalism whatsoever.
Literally yesterday, a jury of his peers in New York City awarded a $3 million defamation damage to E. Jean Carroll, the journalist who said that she was raped and defamed by Donald Trump. They did not have enough evidence to prove her claim of rape, but they did find Trump was liable, not guilty. It was a civil case, not a criminal case. They found Trump liable for sexual misconduct against her and for defamation. The sexual misconduct, they awarded, I believe, a $2 million compensation for that portion, and the defamation was a $3 million compensation. And that was literally less than 24 hours ago, maybe 26 hours ago. And then tonight on CNN, he starts defaming E. Jean Carroll again. Yep. He says he just goes through the whole rap sheet of all the terrible things that he said about E. Jean Carroll. And the thing that is the indelible takeaway from the CNN town hall is the laughter. When he was describing sexual assault, when he was describing E. Jean Carroll's sexual assault, the audience laughed. To them, to Republican primary voters, this is hilarious. Not just that it's false, not just that it's a lie, it's actually very funny.
No, did we need a town hall to understand that his voters, his supporters, nothing he does is out of bounds? Do we need this display to go, oh yeah, did we need this?
Yeah, I mean, 6 years ago we heard obviously they voted with their feet. 63 million Trump voters voted for him after the locker room talk, right? After the Access Hollywood tape came out. And then 74 million of them voted for him a second time in 2020. Is it a shock that a room with 200 or 400 or however many Trump supporters would think that sexual assault is not just like fair game, but actually like a great game to play? No, it's not surprising at all. We've seen a million testimonials about this. It shouldn't have been surprising. But what it did create was really disgusting television. And oddly enough, it actually might have opened up new civil liability against Donald Trump. Like, could E. Jean Carroll sue him again for this? Maybe. Yeah, you know, there's no double jeopardy in civil law. Like, he just maybe committed a new crime. Like, sue him again, sure.
Yeah, $5 million to Trump that he might not pay. It'll take a decade or two decades to get. Does he care about that? No, not really. His ego is so big, it doesn't. None of this stuff matters, I believe.
Yeah, and you and I, here we are now. We've been talking about this for 15 minutes. Like, God, we're back in the morass of the Trump world. Like, he is such a dominant media figure. He makes really compelling TV, right? People watch and they are outraged or they are shocked or they laugh along with him. But this man was prime time for the entirety of his presidency. And even though he was chaotic and dangerous and a lot of people died, millions of Americans lost their lives during the Trump administration that did not have to. I think the excess mortality in the wake of COVID in the U.S. is like over 3 million people. The COVID deaths alone are a million. Like, that's Trump's fault. And yet here he is still dominating on television. And what is CNN, as a ostensibly reliable and legitimate news organization, what are they supposed to do? He's the Republican frontrunner. He actually took a shot at Ron DeSantis that every time Ron DeSantis gets hit by Trump, you just sort of realize, like, this man was not prepared for the Trump show.
Yeah.
He hit DeSantis so hard tonight. He has a 40-point lead on Ron DeSantis, and he is just wailing on him. And he took another shot, a heavy shot, in this town hall that probably landed, if I know anything about how Trump media and Trump supporters are going to respond. You know, he is the Republican frontrunner. He has a 40-point lead. He is almost certainly going to be the Republican nominee, barring some unforeseen circumstance. We don't know what it would take to knock Trump off this pedestal. The media is behind him. Fox is behind him. Newsmax is behind him. They're increasingly competing with one another to see who can get more behind him in the wake of this sort of Tucker Carlson calamity. We find ourselves in a situation where, like, Trump is the inevitable Republican future, and the media is just going, like, they have to change their rules. They have to adopt a new playbook for how to deal with someone like this. You know, we've never had a president run for re-election. We never had a former president run for re-election like this before in over 100 years. The modern media ecosystem entirely evolved after Grover Cleveland's discontinuous presidency. there is no predicate for dealing with this. But we've also never had a president who like led an insurrection against the United States government. We've never had someone who was going to be a Republican nominee who had led a coup. And they don't know how to handle this. And frankly, I don't have all the solutions either, but I instinctively, intuitively, I knew that giving him a town hall and a free rein on for 90 minutes of airtime was not the solution. And boy, howdy, it was not the solution.
No. And look, it was everything I expected it was going to be. And to be honest, it was a little more. I mean, you're right. He did walk himself into a couple of big questions. The Dobbs thing is huge. I mean, he admitted right out there saying, yeah, I put them on the court. They did it. They did what I wanted them to do. I did this. So he kind of he threw them under the bus. I do want to get your thoughts on real quick before you go. Evidently, Tucker Carlson is now moving over to Twitter.
Yeah.
So we're going to get the unvarnished Tucker now. You know, no more having to do what Fox tells him to do. You know, did you see his victim video where, you know, when you're in the media, they tell you what to do and you have to play in that? He really played the victim card. Oh my gosh, so well. But now he's gonna be real now. So all those lies I told you before, I'm gonna be truthful now.
It was actually very interesting. In the middle of that like 2.5 minute video, he's released two videos on Twitter. They're his basically only responses after he was sort of unceremoniously fired by Fox News 2 weeks ago. And in the middle of that video, he actually said, like fact checkers, you know, dweebs like me, and people who report facts like dweebs like you, you know, they actually do report the facts, but it's not the truth. And the truth and the facts aren't the same thing. And what he was going to report on was the truth. And he was going to use this platform to do it. I was not aware that what we were watching for the past 7 years of the White Power Hour in primetime on Fox News, I wasn't aware that that was the varnished Tucker Carlson. I can't imagine. Well, I mean, obviously, I can't imagine where he might go with the sort of imprimatur of Elon Musk and the freedom provided by Twitter. But, you know, we sort of are just now waiting for, like, where is the brick wall that causes him and Elon Musk to have a fight? Because if Tucker Carlson is going to push every boundary, it's going to end up somewhere. And I suspect it'll be something he says in the wake of a school shooting, or something he says in the wake of something truly heinous that he says in the wake of a very high profile event. That even Elon Musk is going to realize, like, that he sort of trapped himself in a cage with a lion. But in the meantime, Tucker Carlson seems like he's going to use this opportunity on Twitter to get increasingly toxic, as Twitter itself has become increasingly toxic and increasingly reflective of the right-wing viewpoints of its owner, Elon Musk. It's increasingly a website that isn't very good, and it also heavily promotes the right-wing content and the stuff that Elon wants to see. And so if you're using Twitter, it's very likely that whenever Tucker starts his limited series or his exclusive videos, that those things are just going to show up in your feed. They're going to be at the top of your For You page. They're going to be recommended right into your right into your feed that you used to use for news or for keeping in touch with friends or for random acquaintances or however it is you use Twitter back in the old days. We're now going to just see a lot more Tucker Carlson on that platform, and that's going to be a real problem for an organization like Twitter. That's bleeding advertising dollars, and where blue chip advertisers and blue chip companies do not want to see their brands associated with this stuff. They were not advertising on Tucker's show on Fox for a reason. And now he's going to be sort of mainlined by Twitter. The fascinating thing is, the money involved. So Tucker seems to have broken a $25 million clause in his exit agreement with Fox News and forfeited that $25 million, which he's going to fight for in court, in exchange for going over to Twitter. But it's possible that Elon can just offer him just far more than the cash value of that Fox contract. It remains to be seen where this goes. But one thing we do know, and I apologize for sort of going on here, but we've seen extremely polarizing, popular, formerly profitable Fox personalities exit before, and they have essentially evaporated. When Glenn Beck left Fox and founded The Blaze, I think in his first full year of operating that organization, he brought in like $95 million, like a fascinating payday. He made as much as like Oprah Winfrey in 2013 or something like that. But Glenn Beck is no longer influential. He's just extremely rich. And he's not influential anymore because Fox News is a political party. It's a political apparatus. And when he was the headliner at Fox News, he was like kind of their president. He was the leader of that party. And when he left, he could make a ton of money in the private sector, but he didn't have the influence anymore that was provided to him by Fox. It's entirely plausible, and it's probably even likely, that Tucker is going to make a lot of money on Twitter and a lot of money from his collaboration with Elon. But whether or not he can have the same influence remains to be seen, because Fox is the political operation. When you run Fox, you run the show.
Yeah.
And you really need look no further than who is the guy that Tucker Carlson replaced. Tucker Carlson was a nobody. And then he replaced Bill O'Reilly, the king of Fox News, the king of conservative media. Bill O'Reilly's still alive. He's just completely obscure now. Tucker replaced him, built upon him, went to heights that Bill O'Reilly could have never seen. And now he'll be replaced too. And the real question isn't really what Tucker Carlson's going to do. The question is, like, is the next Tucker Carlson replacement going to be even worse than Tucker, who was even worse than Bill, who was even worse than Glenn?
And I say yes.
Because that is the system we've seen previously.
Do we have any idea who the replacement was going to be? I've heard people throw out Candace Owens' name a couple of times, and I'm like, I don't know about that. But you know,
I can only imagine.
But I can only imagine it could be somebody worse.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine how many blood vessels would burst for Tucker Carlson if he was replaced by a black woman. But I don't think it'll be Candace Owens. I sort of jokingly remarked that I thought maybe Harris Faulkner from their daytime program would be the next one up. The obvious clone who they have on staff is Will Kane. He has done everything he could to rebuild himself as a sort of right-wing provocateur in Tucker's mold. And this is a guy who used to be like a sideline reporter for ESPN. It's possible it could be someone like Will Kane, who they already have on staff. But it's possible that it's someone who we wouldn't expect. In 2017, you wouldn't have expected Tucker Carlson to be prime time, to be big time, rather. He was like a weekend replacement host. He was the guy who was famous for falling asleep on the set of Fox and Friends once. And then he became, you know, the king of Fox. It's possible that it's going to be someone who we don't expect. They're testing a bunch of different hosts. They tested Brian Kilmeade the first week, then Lawrence Jones. This week, they're testing Kayleigh McEnany. One of our researchers, Ruby Seavey, actually has this really interesting thing that was published on Monday about the 50% decline we saw in that slot, in that 8 p.m. time slot's ratings in the 2 weeks since Tucker left. They need someone who can bring back those viewers. And oddly enough, we actually just saw this in November 2020. Fox lost viewers when they correctly called the 2020 presidential election for Joe Biden. And Tucker brought those viewers back by going all in on white supremacy and all in on the election lie that cost Fox $800 million in the defamation case with Dominion Voting Systems. It's entirely plausible the person who replaces him is going to chase that same dragon and take Fox into another rabbit hole that's going to be disastrous for the network in the same way the Dominion suit was disastrous for them. But that's the only way they can stay relevant is to chase that audience down.
Yeah.
They can't afford to have that many people leave for Newsmax or to log off entirely. They need them.
And they can work out a deal with the Department of Corrections and get Stuart Rhodes from his jail cell. Yeah, who knows? I want to get your thoughts on the latest defamation suit against Fox. Nina Jankowicz, who was on this program, talking about her want to sue Fox. In fact, full disclosure, I actually donated to her campaign to hold Fox accountable. She's actually filed a new defamation suit against Fox. Are we going to see more of these kind of, I know the shareholders are suing. I know there's the Smartmatic suit.
Yeah.
Now this one, will we see a jump in these?
You know, you would think that you would. What the Dominion case and really the settlement in favor of Dominion, what it showed was the predicate for actually winning these cases. I suspect that the next thing we're likely to see is the Smartmatic case will probably settle. Smartmatic is going to demand sort of a king's ransom akin to what was given to Dominion. Murdoch and the family are going to fight back against it. But, you know, I've watched a couple of Jankowicz interviews, including on your program. And it's interesting, there are more people who have been defamed by this network. Some of them are major public figures. Some of them are simply associates of major public figures. It's entirely plausible that there are more defamation cases in the pipeline that are really going to get sort of shaken loose from the tree in the wake of the Dominion defamation settlement. We just don't know. It's still very early, and these things take time. But sometimes this will sort of cascade. And you and I have talked about this previously as a sort of like possible the defamation settlement with Dominion will be like a rainmaker incident for Fox, where you have a first suit that wins and it proves the concept that you can land one of these big settlements. against Fox News, and that there actually are legal boundaries to how much Fox can damage individuals or institutions or companies. And then with the predicate set, you'll see more and more and more, and they'll just snowball and roll downhill. Where this stops, we don't know. But we do know that the last time Fox was so imperiled as they are now, they went full on the defamation to bring that audience back.
Yeah.
And are they going to be willing to do it again?
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News. I'm